busy. So at the end of David's session, we'll be encouraging you to move out principally in that direction, away from the Emporium, but you may also be able to get back into the Emporium from here. Could I just ask you, please, to turn off your mobile phone or put it on silent so as not to distract one another, and as I believe the session is being recorded, you wouldn't like your ringtone to come out on the recording. There should, we hope, be time for some questions and answers at the end of David's session. And in that, I'll bring a roving microphone around. So if you'd be patient and wait and indicate by raising your hand if you'd like to contribute, ask a question. We're sponsored here at Monkey Puzzle by the Church Times newspaper, three copies of which are available in the green stand at that end of the room. And do recommend that you take one to try if you don't know it already. I'm a subscriber. Yeah! And it's really good. While at that end of the room, you can find details about Greenbelt Angels. If you're new to Greenbelt but think we've got something good going on here and you'd like to support it through the year, then think about becoming a friend of Greenbelt, also known as an angel. Watch out for the Church Times Guide to Greenbelt. Another little plug. You can pick this up in the Emporium, I understand. A freebie by one of the Church Times cartoonists. I think that's all I need to tell you for the moment. I'd like to hand over to David, who's going to speak to us of home. Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming to see me. Is everybody comfortable? Are you, or do you want to get sort of closer? Or you're all okay where you are? You're all okay where you are. Okay. It's very strange here. I just want to say from the outset that I'm not a seminar speaker. I've never actually. This is a seminar, isn't it, that we're doing this morning? Yeah. I've never actually run a seminar before. I'm a writer and a social worker. So as you can imagine, in those two worlds, you don't generally get to talk to, certainly not in social work, to large gatherings of people. In social work, in fact, if you talk to anybody, most people don't want to listen to you, whether it's a large gathering or a small gathering. So I won't be offended if you decide to rush off, because I'm kind of used to that. I'm a writer recently. I guess I've always written since I was a little child, but I've come to writing sort of more recently. So my first novel has actually just been published in April. And I've come to Greenbelt for the last 4 years, I think it is. So it's been really nice to actually come here and actually talk at Greenbelt, having come here for so long. So my novel is actually not available in the bookshop. It's great, isn't it? Most people say you can buy my book in the bookshop. But that's my novel, which is called Fitzgerald's Wood. And my publishers forgot to send it to Greenbelt, so there aren't any copies that you can actually buy. But there are going to be some flyers, I understand, that will actually tell you about the book and where you can buy it, should you choose to decide to buy it. What I'd like to do today, if it's okay with you, is just do a few readings from the novel. The theme that I'm talking about is home, and it's a kind of a much broader theme than that, really, that I'd sort of like to look at today. And I guess, in a sense, I'm on a journey of discovery to find what home really is. So I'm not here to give you any answers about home, but to kind of hope that we can share on that journey and discover some few insights into what it is. I'm of mixed parentage. My father's Nigerian and my mother's white British with a little bit of Irish. My grandmother she's actually dead, but I suppose she still is. She was a quarter Irish. No, she was half Irish. So I think that makes my mother a quarter Irish and me a 16th, is that right? The maths? Yeah, something like that. So the whole kind of process for me as somebody of being of mixed parentage is actually to just, you always have this kind of dual identity, this dual kind of challenge, this dual kind of where do you really belong, where are you from, and, you know, being born in Nigeria, growing up in the UK, you always have this sense that you're actually from Nigeria, that's where you were born, but you actually grew up in the UK, so have this kind of dichotomy of two things going on. And that kind of brings to the fore the kind of notion of home, and what does home really mean, and where do you identify with that home, and where do you identify yourself within that? So I wanted to look at really just those whole kind of notions really, and just share with you the kind of the issues. For me really, I mean, I won't tell you my age, but I'm kind of in my around that age, and I grew up in the 70s in the UK, which is a very different experience for young black people growing up in the 70s than it is now. And the 70s really did bring together some of those issues about your identity. And there was, we experienced a lot of racism, which was much more overt and direct than it actually is today. And so you had to continually identify and be challenged about where do you belong, who are you. Becoming a Christian in later life throws the whole sense of identity and changes that sense of identity as well. So you're continually having to reevaluate and look at that in the sense of many forms of identity. And I'm sure that those of you that are not black or who do not have mixed parentage can identify with some of those themes that I'll be talking about. I just wanted to start by way of an icebreaker, really. Does anyone know how to get your porn star name? Have you done that thing before? Has anyone done that? Just to kind of loosen up. If I tell you that my porn... Should I become a porn star at any stage in my life, which is probably unlikely... But my porn star name would be Ricky Freehold. And I just think that's a fantastic name. In fact, I might actually use it on my next novel. So Ricky Freehold, so if I tell you how to get your porn star name, you can perhaps chat to the person next to you in not too a friendly way, because you don't want to take it too far, really, and find out. So the way you get your porn star name is it's the name of your first ever pet that you ever had as a child or in your family. If you didn't have one, then maybe the neighbour's pet or some pet that you remember as significant. So that's the first name. And then the second name is the name of the first street you ever lived in. So, or if you didn't ever live in a street, because we are talking about home, some people have been homeless, it could be your mother's maiden name. So just chat to the person next to you and we'll come back and see what kind of porn star names we've got. Are you chatting to... No. Explain later. Don't blame me for it. Okay, are we okay for porn? Are we okay for that? Yeah? Okay, just like to say that I will be running a porn workshop later on this afternoon as well, if you want to pop along. So, do you want to cover your ears? This young guy here, talking to his mum, the person next to him, discussing porn names. Not good, really. So, let's see. Anyone want to put their hand up? Anyone got... I mean, Ricky Freehold. Can you beat Ricky Freehold? As a porn name, yes. Sorry, say that again. Buzzback Daring Stone Hill. Nah. Z-list pornography, that one. Anyone else? Yeah, over there in the white. Can we... Have we got a mic or... Bunty Manners. I want to see your films, Bunty. Yes, here in the yellow and white. I don't know if I want to say it, really. Was it really? Congratulations. Minnie Lecoq. Need we say more? Minnie, have you got any videos that you're selling? No? Okay. And someone here had their hand up. Yes. Pixie Boys. That's a good one. I like that one. Anyone else got a good porn star name? Okay. Oh, one at the back. Last one at the back. Blue Mouse. You did get the idea of what we were doing, didn't you? And what about the mouse? Was it really? I'd love to come there one day. Okay, thank you very much for doing that. And what I'd like to do now is just to start with a piece. As I said, I was born in Nigeria, grew up in New Haven, which is just down the coast from Brighton. New Haven is a... has anyone been to New Haven? You've been to New Haven. This is not New Haven in Scotland. This is New... I know you've been there. It's my wife. Anyone else been to New Haven? And you have down there. What do you think of New Haven? Are you from New Haven?
No, I studied it for a year.
You studied it for a year? Why would you want to study New Haven for a year? Living there for 4 years is bad enough. Okay. You went to who was it here? New Haven? Yeah, what did you think of it?
Nice port.
Nice port. Okay, well, if you can imagine, I was Nigerian. I was actually born during the beginning of the Biafra War. So there was a civil war going on in Nigeria. And I was the youngest of three children. My older brother and sister were 4 or 5 years older than me. They were actually born in the UK, but then went over to Nigeria, and I was born there, the third child. My mother was there. It was a very traumatic period of our family's life, as you can imagine. The civil war was quite horrendous, really, in Nigeria. And then because of the breakup of my parents' relationship, I then came over back to the UK with my white British mother to live in New Haven. Now, can you imagine in your wildest dreams coming from somewhere like... I lived in eastern Nigeria, and that's all I knew as a baby. I mean, people say you don't remember very much when you're... You know, I came over when I was one, just over one. But you don't remember so much consciously, but subconsciously, there's all that kind of processing going on and all that kind of information that is being fed into you about who you are and you're establishing your identity. And so for me to come and be uprooted from Nigeria at that kind of age... And then I came over to New Haven in East Sussex. Now, can you imagine the only thing they've got in common is the N, Nigeria and New Haven. I mean, New Haven is a completely different place to Nigeria. And when I came over to New Haven, I came over with my white mother and then her white family, and no contact after that with my Nigerian father, relatives, etc. Now, the people that brought me up when I was a child, there was my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, my grandparents, the whole issue about their daughter. My mother was the kind of rebel daughter who married, you know, she didn't do well at school, and then she went and married a black man. And you can imagine in the 60s how that was. My grandparents were very kind of like upper working class, lower middle class, kind of that kind of, you know, place. And my grandmother, I'm sure she was convinced that she was related to the Queen somewhere down the line, because even though she's a lovely woman, but she just thought she had all this kind of grandeur about her, you know. So you thought you were in the presence of royalty and things like that. And then my mother and her sisters. I mean, my English family are the most eccentric family I've ever met, and I grew up with them. And they're very odd, very strange family. And so there I was, little black child growing up in New Haven, surrounded by this very strange white family, and this very strange kind of New Haven, which was very different. Now, when my novel came out this year, there was an article in the local newspaper about me, and it discussed the fact that I'd come from Nigeria, blah, blah, blah. Someone's got a message. And my auntie, because I always, when I said in the article that I was the only black child in the whole universe for the whole of my first formative years, there was no, until my brother and sister came over in the 70s, there was nobody else around apart from me. Now, so they then came over in 1970. My auntie, who's very, very lovely, very strange, though, when she read this in the article in the local newspaper, she took offence to the fact that I'd written that I was the only black child in my universe and the only black child growing up in New Haven. And she said, and I said, there was no such thing as a black community. You just didn't know about it, so you had no sense of who you were as a black person at all. She took real issue. She said, she phoned up my mother. She didn't phone me directly. She phoned up my mother. She said, I'm really upset with David. And she said, why is that? And he said, what nonsense that when he was growing up in New Haven, there was no black community. And then my mum said, well, what were they then? And she said, what about his brother and sister? And that was like, that was her understanding of, you know, what a black community was like. As long as you've got a brother and sister, you're okay, so you can kind of form your identity. Now, have you got brothers and sisters, people here? You do not form sort of kind of great bonding identities with your brother and sisters, do you, in your formative years, because you're always kind of arguing and trying to establish your own identity. So that was how it was for me, really. So, and my auntie was very kind of cross that I, you know, neglected to mention those two. So this is a piece that I wrote that went into the Observer in February, and it just kind of sums up, this isn't in the novel, but it's a kind of piece that sums up the experience for me of coming from Nigeria to New Haven. So I'll just read this. It's a long way from Nigeria to New Haven. I was born in a place of dust and sand and dance and music and stories, a place so far away that growing up in England, you had to have a good memory to really remember what it was even there in the first place. When I was a baby, I sat in the sun and I could smell the sweet smell of the land and hear the buzz of the flies and taste the fresh mangoes on my lips. When I was a baby, I sat on my father's knee in the shade, hidden from the sun, and thought quiet little thoughts in my head. I thought that it would always be like this, that I would always sit on my father's knee, and that the flies would always buzz, and that my mother would always kiss me on my cheeks, and that her kiss would feel warm like the warm feeling in my tummy. I didn't know then that what it was would not always be. But I did know that tummy rhymes with mummy. Not in my head, not then, of course. I was too young, but in my heart, in the place where stories are made of. Before I knew how old I was, before I could remember what I remember now, somebody picked me up, tucked me into my crib, swaddling clothes and all, put me in a boat, and took me to a place called New Haven. Mummy, who rhymed with tummy, was still there, but Daddy's knee was strangely not there anymore. And knees are like that, I've since learned, always given up when you most need them. And in New Haven, the dust was replaced by pebbles, the sun by chimneys, the mangoes by penny chews, and the heat replaced with a mist that brought the boats in from beyond the sea. And the flies didn't buzz anymore, and the seagulls spoke in tongues, and the greengrocer ruffled my hair and said, "Coloured baby," and he smiled and frowned, and he didn't know what he should really say, so he said, "Granny Smith's, tuppence a pound." At school they taught me to read, and the words felt good on my tongue like pear drops on a Tuesday. The books smelt good too, like memories of tomorrow covered in syrup, and my feet wanted to dance to the rhythm of the words that I read, to dance like the Jackson Five. But all I could do was write down my own words and spin them around, throw them in the air, and make them a story, make them a new song. And so I've written a story now, and it's a long way from page one to the very end, almost as far as it is from Nigeria to New Haven and back again. And putting pen to paper was the hardest and most natural thing of all, twisting and turning everything into new places and people and thoughts. And when did I write? Well, most of the real writing, I think, was done in my head, in the space between pen and paper. But by day I worked as a social worker, and by night and at the crack of dawn and at weekends and in the library at lunchtime, I scribbled and the characters told me their stories. And I felt tired and I felt happy and I felt tired again. And that's where Fitzgerald's Wood was born. Not in my life, not in the stars, but somewhere in between. In the space between Nigeria and New Haven and now. In the space between losing and finding. In the space between life and imagination. In the space between the slush pile and the acceptance letter. In the space between the beginning, the middle, and the end. So that was a piece that I think kind of sums it up, the feelings for me of that kind of transference from one place to another, and that transference from one home to another and back again. And that is, in a sense, what kind of triggered thinking through the whole kind of issues of my childhood and thinking through the whole kind of home issue and what does home mean to me, inspired me to write the book that I've written. When I looked on Google to find out, I thought I better do this because you're meant to sort of have little aids and adaptions and things like that. And I looked on Google to find out what Google, if you tap in the word home, how many words would come up and what could you get from it. And do you know, I've written it down here, how many came up? I think it was 2 billion. 2,620,000 hits for home, or the meaning of home, if you go onto Google. And I was amazed, really. And these are some of the things that the word home actually describes and uses. Home is one of the first words that children learn. And home is a place. It's a place that you live at any particular time. Some of these sound obvious, but it's quite interesting when you actually listen to them. Home is a domicile, abode, or habitation. Home is a social unit formed by a family living together. Home also refers to the environment, offering affection and security. Home is where the heart is. He grew up in a Christian home. There's no place like home, and home sweet home. And as we get older, the word home can take on negative connotations. And we think of the words nursing home, which in this culture has a negative connotation. Or we refer to rest homes, where people go to rest, and then inevitably the next step is to die. And then we think of old folks homes. And then we say things like, we're going to put grandpa into a home. So there's a twist on the whole notion of home. Grandpa, we're going to take from his home and put him into a home. And it becomes a kind of a negative. In this culture, and the way that we view older people in this culture can become a negative. In other cultures, it's not seen in the same way. In Nigeria, for instance, the older person is still to this day venerated. I mean, these things are changing, and as we're a globalized world now, and things do change, and there's influences from the West, but older people are generally seen as esteemed and looked up to. And I think I've kind of brought that into the book. One of the things that really made me happy was that there was a book, there's a magazine called, it used to be called Saga, I'm not sure what it's called now. Does anyone know what it's for? Is it called Saga? I think it is. And it's for older people, and it's for people over 55. Doesn't give us long, does it, before they start saying that we're older and we start, you know, reading Saga and things like that. But I was really chuffed because Saga made Fitzgerald's Wood Book of the Month about 2 months ago. And I was very pleased because if anyone should read the book, there's lots of older characters in the book. And for me, older people are very important and the influence of older people. But I'll come back to that if I remember. And home can mean the country that we live in, which is obvious. But then if you're from one country, growing up in another country, you have a mixed parentage, then that's one of the confusions that you can live in. What is home, really? In America, they have their interest in home and abroad. So they have these kind of policies that affect home and abroad. Your place of origin is your home. Salmon, I don't know why this is in there, but salmon return home to spawn. It's an interesting thing. And then in polite conversation, people are always saying, where's your home? Where do you come from? Now, that's a kind of, people say that politely and don't necessarily mean anything by that. But when you're growing up as a black person in the 70s, and you know you are of mixed race, so you have a white parent and a black parent, but one of the questions is people are always asking is, where do you come from? Where's your home? And I was actually born in Nigeria, so I could always, as a child, refer back and say, well, I'm Nigerian. But you soon become aware that, yes, I'm Nigerian in one sense, but actually you're growing up in a UK community and you're very much English. One of the things I found writing the novel, the main theme in the novel is about a young child who's 13 who loses his father at the very beginning of the novel. And his father is of mixed parentage and he's from Nigeria. But he'd never actually been to Nigeria. He had a Nigerian parent and his father really struggled with that sense of identity and where he came from. And the son in the novel then goes on a journey with the father's ashes to actually discover where his father come from. And in the novel, he actually goes back to Nigeria and then comes back again. And there's this sense that people are always asked, you know, where do you come from? And there is this ongoing sense of searching for that and trying to find out where that is really from. So could I just say one thing, actually, about the expression dual heritage and the changing shifts in expression? Being of mixed parentage, not so long ago it was mixed race. Previous to that it was something else, I can't remember what, but it continually changes. The latest thing is, and I'm a social worker, so it's probably actually changing as we speak. By 12 o'clock it'll be something different. But the latest, as far as I know, is dual heritage. That's to refer to someone like me, in polite circles. Now, I always found that very interesting because it's a strange thing, isn't it? I'm dual heritage. It sounds like, you know, what are you? I'm dual heritage, and I'm also a member of the National Trust. You know, that's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like, you know, this person is a member of the National Trust and this person is dual heritage. And you can get in free to certain things if you're a National Trust member, but you can't if you're dual heritage. You know what I mean? It's like, but you should do with a name like that, shouldn't you? And I should be able to go to Buckingham Palace and knock the door and say, I'm of dual heritage, let me in. And they should let me in. But anyway, that's an interesting digression. But the expressions change. I do apologise, I'm probably waffling here. Can I just say another thing? I was in Edinburgh last week. I went up to the festival in Edinburgh, and I saw, this is a real digression, I do apologise, but I saw a sandwich bar called Lettuce Surprise. Did someone say yes? They know it. No? Oh. Lettuce Surprise, a sandwich bar. And I stood there, and if you're going to open a cafe, a restaurant, and you want to attract people in, are you going to really name it Lettuce Surprise? And I stood there, you know, what could a lettuce do to surprise you? Do you know what I mean? You know, I could only think of three things, or maybe two things. One is it could pretend to be a cabbage, I guess, if it really felt inclined to do that. The other thing I guess it could do would be to say it doesn't like vegetarians, you know. And that's two. I could only think of two things. What an odd name to do for a cafe. Anyway, I do digress. So, going back to my upbringing. So, New Haven, And then within that, one of the things that added to this whole sense of identity and searching was when I came back over to, when I came to New Haven, because my mother had to, my grandparents were not very happy with the situation. I could have lived with them, but my mother didn't have anywhere to live. My father was off the scene, didn't really want to know. So actually, we had nowhere to live for a while. My mother had to go back to study. She had to do something. Her parents said, you're not going to live here and do nothing, so you need to go and get yourself a trade. So she went to study as a nurse. So I actually had, at 2 years old, had nowhere to live. So fortunately at the time, a fostering arrangement was made, and I went to live with a foster mother from the ages of 2 to 4. And that was within, and she was a wonderful woman. She was a real hippie. She lived in a house called Four Winds that was on the top of a hill. And I think for me at the point, one of the things that helped me to get through was that sense of having somewhere safe to go at that kind of turmoil. But then shortly following that, my brother and sister came over. And we actually then, because we could no longer, I couldn't stay in the foster arrangement anymore. And then we had to go and live in a caravan. We were homeless for about 9 months. So we lived in a caravan for where poor people who had nowhere to live went to live, which was on another hill. There's lots of, not many hills in Nigeria, but there's a few. So we lived in a caravan. So that sense of rootlessness and was just kind of further exasperated by those kind of experiences as a young child. But having said that, the period in the foster placement was a great period of stability and gave me a sense of comfort. And I think one of the things that it's actually done is helped to shape my identity and helped me to feel kind of connected. I was brought up by women. The men in my family my father disappeared in Nigeria. I didn't see him, although I've had contact more recently with him. Spoke to him for the first time in 24 years just last week. But as a child, he wasn't there. My brother had health problems, so he was kind of around, but you know, not around at the same time for various different reasons. And then my grandfather, my white English grandfather, he was a really funny guy, because although he was there, he was asleep most of the time. And if you remember, he's married to the woman who thinks she's the queen, and I think that was his kind of way out of dealing with being married to the queen. So he was known in our house by my grandmother as semi-conscious. So that's what she used to refer him to. And so he was not really a great influence on me, because when he was awake, he was only awake for a short period of time. So I never really got, if he was saying something, discussing something, you never got to the end of what it was, because he'd fall asleep by the time that, so you never got the punchline, whatever. And another funny thing is when he was dying, he died of leukemia when he was in his 70s. And he was a funny man, my grandfather, because like when he was awake, he was quite humorous. And when he was dying, the Queen came along to see him as he was dying in his bed in hospital. And I think he had about 2 days to live, and he was really at the end of the line. And he was sitting there talking to the Queen, and she said, he said to her, you know, Francis, we've been married 50 years. And I think she thought there was going to be some kind of really romantic kind of thing coming up, you know, just before he died, because they had a bit of a kind of, you know, difficult relationship. 50 years we've been married, Francis, 50 years. And then he looked at her and he said, that's 50 years of roast on Sundays and bubble and squeak on Mondays. And she looked back to him and said, Bill, that's an absolute lie. We don't always have bubble and squeak on Mondays. And then he keeled over and died. Well, not literally, but you know. So now that's an interesting thing is bubble and squeak. Because, and this comes up in the book actually, is the whole notion, one of the things, I must just tell you something else actually. When I was a teenager, when I was actually exploring my sense of black identity when I was a teenager, does anyone remember the band Black Uhuru that were around in the 80s, a reggae band? And Uhuru is a Swahili word which means freedom. And so it's black freedom. And most young black people who grow up in the UK will go through a time when they need to establish their identity and that sense of freedom, that black kind of focus about who you are. And it's almost a given, an essential thing to establish yourself. And I was very much into that. And I was about, I was at school, so I was about 15 at the time, and I had a black Uhuru badge on, red, gold, and green with the rest of colours and everything. And we had this teacher, I won't tell her name because she might be here, you never know. But she was a lovely teacher, but she was very, very middle class, very kind of posh, very kind of... We went to a really rough school, and she was kind of like a fish out of water in the school. And I remember once I was walking down the corridor at school, and I had on this Black Uhuru badge, and she came up to me, and she sort of peered at the badge, and she said, David, what a very interesting badge. And I said, yes, miss, it's a reggae band. She said, And what exactly is it? Black Uhuru. I said, well, miss, it's a reggae band, and it's a Swahili word, and it means freedom, black freedom. And she said, oh, how very interesting. And then she kind of leaned back and she said, David, are you terribly unfree? And that was her understanding of the oppression for young black people in the 70s, that she just really didn't get it. And she was just, it was funny. Anyway, I'm going back, I'm digressing, I'm coming back, bear with me. Grandfather semi-conscious. Charlie Chaplin said, you probably know this, but comedy is tragedy plus distance. Or actually, he didn't say that, that's someone else. He said, life is a tragedy in close-up, but it's a comedy in long shot. So tragedy is comedy, comedy is tragedy plus distance. That's a very important thing to remember, I think. Because when you're going through the experiences, for me, it always seemed as a young child that you're kind of really struggling through and you're really trying to get through and you're really trying to work out who you are. You're kind of fighting against the forces that are against you. And, you know, many, many young black people, particularly young black people of mixed parentage, anyone who's a social worker here would know, many, many young black people of mixed parentage end up within the care system or end up in the prison system because of this sense of urgency and this sense of, like, trying to establish who they are and being confused about their identity. Now, the reason I say that Charlie Chaplin said this about tragedy being comedy being tragedy in long shot, is that for me, there was a point when I felt it could have all gone really quite wrong, and I could have lost the kind of thread a bit, really, with all of this. And I've seen many of my peers of mixed parentage kind of lose it a bit. But for me, I think what I was always doing, I always had a love of books as a child and a love of kind of escape. And I guess anyone who reads here, you know that sense, and sense of looking for the other, and the sense of looking that what you see is not necessarily what you get. And that there is something better beyond the pages of the book that's open before us. And we need to, you know, and for me it was always about searching for that something better, something the other, something beyond this. So what I was kind of doing as a young child and as a teenager is kind of clocking all of this and taking it all in and recording this. I remember once I listened to Mira Sayal, and she was talking about Asian women, Asian people within the community. And she grew up in Dudley, I think it was, a village near Dudley in Birmingham, the only Asian family in Dudley. And I remember one thing hearing her say, that someone asked her a question about what was it like, and she said, well, actually, what it was like was that she always felt like an outsider. And in many ways, you're made to feel that that's kind of a negative, to be an outsider is a negative, you don't belong. And I've never really felt that I belong anywhere. And in some senses, although that's a kind of negative, and that can lead to traumas in some senses, it actually does... It has kind of given me a sense of being able to step back. Sorry, not too far from the mic. To step back and actually have a look and observe things that are going on and how people interact. So one of the blessings about being of mixed parentage or of dual heritage or the National Trust is that you can actually stand back and you can observe two different cultures and you can see the conflicts and you can see the kind of confusions. But if you kind of have a little bit of savvy, you can stand back, record it, and actually use it for good and work with it. What I've tried to do in what I've now done in finding with writing is that all that kind of stuff has come through and been processed, and I've actually been able to put it into writing fiction and actually use the kind of experiences of being within that environment. One other thing that that was really crucial for me growing up was going to see the Black and White Minstrels. Does anyone remember the Black and White Minstrels? You don't really want to remember them, do you? And you know, they were only phased out, I think it was, in 1981 or something ridiculous like that. For those of you who don't know the Black and White Minstrels, way back in the 20s or whatever, in America, they used to have minstrel shows where people, originally there were black people who would dress up and they would put on ludicrous face makeup and they would entertain people and they would be very jolly, very nice and sing jolly songs and look really stupid and do stupid things. But all the people that were oppressing them would come along and enjoy it and it would be funny. Ha ha. In the 70s in the UK, does anyone remember Seaside Specials and all those things, programs like that? In the 70s, they used to have a program called the Black and White Minstrels, which was a spin-off of the whole kind of minstrel thing from America, where white people, white men, would dress up and black their faces up and have white around their eyes and then white lips. And then they'd have white women who would dance and sing with them and do whatever they did and sing songs. Now, my mum, she's a funny woman, but I won't go into her. She used to. We used to watch this in in total, she was in total kind of whatever, I don't know, denial that we were black or whatever. In fact, my mum, she refuses to refer to me as black. She says, you're just David. She doesn't see me as black. So we used to watch the Black and White Minstrels. And my only time of going to London as a young child, although I've lived in London now as an adult, but as a child, the only time she took us to London to meet the black community and be around black people was to go and see the Black and White Minstrels at the London Palladium. And I remember going up on the train and being all excited, you know, we're going to see black people and stuff, and it was the Black and White Minstrels. Anyway, I digress. In fact, my whole talk has been a digression, and I do apologise. So, I'm talking about home. I ought to read something. Shall I read something from the book? Okay. As I said, the book is about a young child who is 13, called Fitzgerald's Wood. His father, the guy I spoke about, who's of mixed parentage, Nigerian English, he loves wood and he has a passion for wood and he's a carpenter. Now, I couldn't put up a shelf. I didn't even know, you know, those things called that you have to get a straight line with. What are they called? Spirit level. I thought Spirit Level was a band in the 80s. I wasn't aware that it was a thing you put up. So I couldn't put up shelves or anything like that. And in fact, a very dear friend of mine has actually pointed out, I did contact the carpenter and got research and stuff. And looked into that. Because I don't know anything about wood, I just had to kind of, you know, discover it. But a very dear friend of mine has pointed out one or two errors in the wood department. But don't worry, it's only fiction. It's fiction, isn't it? And it's like, it's a novel. So if you do, this is just a bit about when Fitzgerald is talking to his dad about what it means to be African. And I hope I've got the right bit. Yes, okay. And what he does, his father, Fitzgerald's father... And I actually, the one thing for me, not having a father growing up, was nice, because in a sense, what I decided to do with the book was just kill off the father from the beginning, because I didn't have a father. So I didn't have to kind of worry about that. But what I actually found out was, really, I wanted to actually discover what it was like to have a father. And in writing the book, I actually found out I could just fantasize with having a father and make up a father and just go with that and play with that. And it was actually really quite cathartic to actually write about a father when you haven't had a father. And that does link me into my relationship with God, which I will come on to afterwards, because we are at a Christian festival after all, aren't we? So I ought to do something like that. Okay. I loved my father's shed. The first day I can really remember thinking about being African was outside my father's shed. It was the same day I passed my 10-yard swimming certificate, although in truth, I only actually managed 9 yards. But Mrs. Craven, the swimming instructor, let me off the last yard and said I could make it up when I went for my 25-yard test. I was 7 at the time. My father had always told me that I was part African, but he never actually told me which part was African. When I was very young, I would be confused by his references to only part of me being African. I remember sitting on a stool outside my father's shed, my hair still damp from the semi-victorious swim, every now and then my left ear popping as I hadn't dried it properly. My father had made the stool during a particularly creative period shortly after he'd had an ingrowing toenail removed at St. Roderick's. At the time, he'd also made 2 other stalls, a rocking horse for Clyde, the boy at number 12, who was dying of leukemia. My mother told me that Clyde had rocked it every day for 3 months until he had died. And then after his death, his mother had put the horse outside her door. For 2 weeks, it remained outside the door, and everyone in our street placed their own floral tributes on it. The tributes became so numerous that it was soon impossible to see the rocking horse and Clyde's grieving mother. She had difficulty getting... Sorry, not to see her... to see Clyde's grieving mother, who had difficulty getting in and out of the front door. The fragrance from the flowers grew stronger and more alluring by the day, however, and passers-by would stop outside the house, holding their noses in the air to breathe in the heady aroma. It was an aroma that masked the smell of death well. Eventually, the bin men came and took the flowers and the horse away. They were thrown on the council skip, as neither Clyde's mother nor father could bear to have the horse back into either of their houses. It was the only one of my father's finished creations that he had knowingly allowed to be thrown away. My father also made a coffee table for the front room, which we never used as our front room was too small and we all thought it got in the way, and a pair of clogs for Hannah, my school friend, whose family were moving to go and live in the Netherlands. "Where's the Netherlands, Dad?" I asked my father as he rolled a baccy ball and put it into his mouth. "In the back of beyond, somewhere in the nether regions," my father answered. The word nether seeming to amuse him so much that he almost choked on his baccy ball. He coughed so violently I had to rush inside and get him a glass of water. "What's wrong?" my mother asked, looking up from the kitchen table where she was completing a crossword. The nether regions are making Dad cough, I said, running back out with my glass full of water. Oh, my mother said, and she went back to finishing her crossword. My father never allowed me into his shed at the bottom of the garden. He said I couldn't come in case the wood fairies got me. He would always make me sit on the stool outside the door, which was propped open with his bruised and battered copy of the Official Rules of Sports and Games, a hefty volume which I never actually saw my father read, or for that matter, show any interest in. I was allowed to peek into the shed and would watch as my father chiselled, sawed and planed, but I was never allowed in. Neither was my mother. He said I would be safer on the stool as the wood fairies only ever came out at night, and only then if all the children in the neighbourhood were asleep. As my father sawed into a particularly stubborn piece of wood, he told me that I was African and that I should be proud of it. I was only part African, he told me, but added that there was no reason why I shouldn't be as proud to be African as someone who was wholly African. My father stopped his sawing and came over to me, his great frame towering over me like the Blackpool Tower that I'd seen on a postcard that my Uncle Albie had sent us that summer. Don't you ever forget your African, son, he said, placing his huge hands on my shoulders and squeezing them, his blue eyes penetrating deep within me. As he spoke, I could smell the warm aroma of baccy balls on his breath. Specks of sawdust floated through the air between us, making my nose twitch. And the words, "you're African," held me spellbound. At the time, I didn't know what African was or how I could have part of it in me. I only knew that my father said I should be proud of it, and so I would. But it would have been helpful if my father had gone on to explain why. He didn't. Instead, he released my shoulders and went back to the stubborn piece of wood. Every night before I went to sleep, I would usually say the Lord's Prayer through once and then touch wood seven times, usually the wooden frame around the mirror above my bed. My mother taught me to say the Lord's Prayer, even though she didn't see herself as religious. And to touch wood, she thought she was very superstitious, and she thought touching wood was for luck and it would help to keep me in Jesus' good books. I don't really believe in prayer or in Jesus, Fitzgerald, she said. But it's better to err on the side of caution. If Jesus is the Son of God, I wouldn't want you to be in his bad books. She also told me that saying the Lord's Prayer would help me to keep the bad spirits away, and I often hoped it would keep the wood fairies away too. And once, after a particularly exciting day spent standing on the breakwater with my grandma at Marvel's Point near her house on the coast, I was so tired I fell asleep before I got to seven and only actually touched wood six times. I woke in the morning from an undisturbed sleep and remembered my nocturnal emission. There was no sign of any bad spirits or wood fairies having visited me during the night, and the house seemed perfectly normal. I could hear Bix Beiderbecke's clarinet marmalade playing downstairs, which meant that my mother was happy. So all must be well. I didn't tell my mother of my previous night's somnolent error, but made sure that the next night I touched wood eight times, an extra one just in case. On the night my father told me I was African, after I'd said the Lord's Prayer and touched wood, I stood looking at myself in the mirror. I gazed at every part of my reflection, every nook and cranny of my brown skin, and tried to work out which part of me was African and how I could be proud of it. I wondered whether Africa was a place I could go and see. Perhaps my father would take me there one weekend instead of visiting my grandma's. I wondered if being African was like being a good swimmer, and that if I tried hard enough, I could get even better at it and make my father even more proud of me, or at least the part of me that was African. From that day on, my father told me very little else about Africa or of being African, except that I should be proud of it. After I finished looking in the mirror, I folded my school uniform and put away my grey socks at the back of my top drawer. My father once said, "Always put your socks at the back of your drawer, son. Then if they're smelly, there's less chance your mother will notice them." I made up my mind that the next day I would ask Mrs. Shower, the dinner lady, why I should be proud to be African. Mrs. Shower knew everything. She'd once told me how to make the fastest aeroplane in my class and how to store my marbles without chipping them. I was disappointed with her answer. All she said was that I was British, that I was born here, and that I didn't need to worry my little head with finding out about Africa. I didn't know why, but her answer disappointed me at the time. Somewhere deep inside, I knew it just didn't feel right. So that's just a little section of the book. We do want to stop for questions. Just to kind of tidy up, just going back on, as I said, to the whole relationship with God. I became a Christian in 1988, I think it was, and it's a very interesting kind of coming together, really, of the... Before that, I kind of dabbled with Rastafarianism, as you can tell by the dreadlocks, which still haven't gone. Although I was never really convinced with the whole notion of... I don't want to disrespect Rastafarians, so I won't, but I was never entirely convinced with the whole notion of some of their aspects. I was quite convinced with the Ganja at the time, but that's that's another story. So I dabbled with that and became a Christian in 1988, and I was one of these people who became a Christian kind of, you know, oh, light shining, flashbang wallop, what a lovely picture and all that. And I always thought that I would just be the best Christian there is and nothing would faze me, and, you know, I'd be out there and I'd be telling them and, you know, banging people over the head. As you all know, those of you that are believers, it's a long journey, and it's, for me, I've calmed down now a lot. I used to think everything pre-98 was bad and everything after that was, you know, good. I don't no longer believe that now. The whole story of my life, the whole journey of my life is a journey from beginning to middle to end. And it's a journey of the relationship with God for me. I'm probably not a very good Christian now, like most of us here are probably not, if we're really honest. And we struggle with various different aspects of our life. For me, the one time I feel truly connected to my God, to Jesus, is through the creation of, for me, it's writing. So I feel a sense of connection with the Spirit through writing, and that sense of being connected to the Creator. And as I've said, for me now, it seems like a journey, and a journey of discovery. And there's more questions than there are answers for me. So I'm very, very disconcerted by some of the more dogmatic kind of approaches to faith. I actually don't regularly go to church, and I'm going to be stoned at the back of one of the tents later on this afternoon for not doing that. But come along and watch, it should be quite entertaining. So I don't actually regularly go to church, but I haven't lost my faith, I haven't backslidden or anything like that. But what I've actually, the one place for me that I actually found 4 years ago, I think it was Greenbelt. And so I say this to people and they say, don't say it, Dave, it sounds really crazy. But my church at the moment is coming to Greenbelt. So I come here every year and I'm around people who give me the space to kind of reflect on my faith. And when I drive away at the end of Greenbelt on the Tuesday morning, it just, I think, oh, that was, you know, that's such a long time to the next one. And before you know it, you're driving back in again. And it seems to me like my excuse that I say to people, why don't, it's just a week, you know, it's just a week, 7 days, it's a Sunday, you know, I just come back every year. And that's it. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily is the best thing, and we all have our own kind of approaches, but that's where I'm at now. And for me, writing and finding that has been a sense of finding my relationship with God through writing. And this whole thing about life being a journey, and there's a song by Joni Mitchell where she talks the circle game, where she talks about the circle, and she talks about people getting on. 1 minute there's the young boy, gets onto the carousel, goes around and round, then he's a man, then he gets off, and then another person gets on, and there's this whole sense of, and that for me is the kind of sense of exploring my relationship with God now and where it's at, and that sense that I'm on a journey, and it's an interesting journey with more questions than answers. So I haven't taught you anything and I've digressed, but thanks very much. And just to say about the book, that, like I say, it's not available here, unfortunately, but it's in every good bookshop. Actually, it's not in most, no, it is. There will be some flyers, apparently, that are around to tell you how you can get hold of it. And it's published by Jonathan Cape, and it's called Fitzgerald's Wood. So has anyone got any comments or any questions? We've got 5 minutes.
I'll tell you about an incident that occurred in my life and see what you think of it. I sell advertising space for a living. It means phoning up companies, talking to the marketing director or managing director and getting them to buy space and trade directories and yearbooks and things. Now, once a few years ago, I dealt with a company in Glasgow. Marketing director was a Mr. McGrath, very broad Glaswegian accent. Sorry if there are any Glaswegians here. Spoke to him, negotiated with him for about 3 weeks on the phone, and then faxed him an allocation form. He'd agreed to buy space. He couldn't fax it back. His fax went down. So he said, don't worry, I'm coming to London next week. I'll drop in and give it to you in your office. Sure enough, next week, had a call from reception. There's a Mr. McGrath from Partick in reception. Went down there into reception and stopped him a track. There's a black guy in reception. Broad Glaswegian accent, turns around and says, Mr. Sutton, Jock McGrath, Partick, pleased to meet you. This guy was born and bred in Glasgow. Expert on Scotch whiskey, was a Celtic fan, preferred fish suppers and carryouts to Jamaican patties and what have you. The only fact of his life that I didn't know, his mother was Jamaican. But his whole culture that he'd been raised in and imbibed and had become a whole part of him was Southwest Scotland. Any comments on that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is very interesting. People always assume, you know, for black people living in the UK, that your identity is still, people still think your identity is actually based somewhere else. Now, there is a truth and there's a combination. I mean, when I watch football matches, I support Nigeria over England. And that's it. I was born in Nigeria, and I've tried to ingrain that into my son, who's actually obviously born here. I have a white wife, that he should support Nigeria over England. And it's not a good thing to do, really, is it? You know what I mean? It's like kind of throwing that kind of thing. But you can understand it. There's actually a very good writer called Luke Sutherland, who was brought up in, I think it was the Hebrides. He's a young black man. I think he's in his 30s, and he's doing very well, written a few novels. One's called Venus as a Boy, and one called Jelly Roll. He was brought up, and I've never met him, but I assume he has a very broad Scottish accent. The thing is that black people now in the UK, we are here, in every kind of facet of society, and in every part of the UK now, and it's a very changing face. And there's lots of young, in the sense of the writing world, there's lots of black voices now coming through in the writing world. Diana Evans, 26A, her book is on sale in here. She's just won the Orange Prize for new writers. She's a brilliant Nigerian British writer. That's another voice. And I think for anybody who is living in Britain and has an investment in Britain, I think it's good for us to hear those different voices and listen to the experiences. We've now got third generation, from immigrant families here in the UK. And, we are going to be here. We're not going anywhere, and we're not going back home and the things that we were told to do in the 70s and things like that. So I think there is a broad experience now and a wealth of experience that adds to the whole, makeup of the UK now.
I think we've got time for one or two more, and okay. This lady here.
I really quite sympathise with everything you said, because my third daughter is adopted. Mm. She's a member of the National Trust as well.
I thought you were going to say the National Trust.
she has very similar background to you. We adopted her in the 70s.
So I'm not a member of the National Trust.
I know,
but I know someone who is.
I know. She is a quarter Nigerian.
Yeah.
Instead of her, your Irish background, she has a Welsh background as well. And we brought her up in a very white, very Welsh little village in West Wales. She has never been curious about her background, and that I'm more curious than she is, actually. I just wondered what drove you to find or how much contact you've had with your Nigerian family. You said you'd spoken to your father. Was that must have been a very sort of disturbing, traumatic experience?
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I'm only me, and my experience is not necessarily the same for everybody, but for me it was a sense of loss of father, and I think I've always been striving to find the father, and that also leads me quite conveniently to looking for God, God, the notion of the fatherhood of God. But I mean, I was very comfortable with the mother relationship and being around women. And very comfortable with the whole mother relationship of God and that kind of sense of it. But the missing link for me has always been the father. So that's the kind of thing that drove me in the sense. And also, people referred in the book, shall I just read a quote from Saint Columbanus? That makes me sound really cool, doesn't it? From a saint here. This kind of sums it up, really, in the sense of searching for where... For me, it's about the searching for where we really come from, which ultimately is greater than Africa, greater than the UK. Saint Columbanus said, "O life, a road to life art thou, not life. And there is no man makes his dwelling on the road, but walks there. And those who fare along the road have their dwelling in the fatherland." And you could use the motherland for that as well. I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. So, and for me, it's a sense of being driven to actually find that sense and to be complete. And to have that, I think it was more profound for me because I was born in Nigeria and because my father was not around from the age of one. People have different experiences. Being adopted or fostered does bring to light as well some of those things. And obviously that's a whole... It would take me hours to look into that, but, Okay.
I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there, as we do need to clear the tent for the next speaker, who's Roy Jenkins. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.